Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at offbeatoregon.com with the daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. And it's Friday, which means this is going to be a brand new show, which has just come out from under the 60-day embargo period during which our participating newspapers have exclusive rights. Reruns are for Mondays and Tuesdays and Wednesdays and Thursdays. Fridays are for new stuff. Thanks for downloading, and I hope you enjoy the show. This story was first published on November 11th of 2018 under the headline, Pro Tip, Model T Engines Make Lousy Airplane Motors. Here we go. Part of the problem with owning and operating the only flight school in town in the 1920s and 1930s was every time one of your students slapped together some home-built piece of kit, you'd be expected to help get it in the air. At least, that seems to have been how it worked for Ted Barber, owner of Bend Flying Service and Central Oregon's first commercial aviator. "I was never one to back away from adventure in an airplane," Barber wrote in his autobiography, The Barnstorming Mustanger. "I always figured airplanes were made to fly, and I was made to fly them." This was a nice general principle, but it's easy to see how applying it too generously could shorten a fellow's life a bit. Luckily for Ted, building a home built in the interwar years was not easy to do. The problem wasn't with engineering. There were plenty of good workable plans for home-built airplanes, and lots of people could and did put them together in barns and sheds. The problem was with power. It was hard to find an engine lightweight enough to get off the ground with an airplane attached to it, especially in the thin air of Central Oregon's high desert, 3,500 feet above sea level. Every now and then, though, someone would come up with something, and Ted would have to choose between telling the student no and helping him fly the thing, and, by helping him fly it, I mean, go first. This came close to cooking Ted Barber's goose one day in the early 1930s when the Stevens brothers called him over to check out their new home built, a super light parasol wing monoplane with a super heavy Ford Model T engine bolted to the front. The brothers hoped that the lightness of the airframe would make up for the fact that the flathead flivver mill weighed close to 500 pounds while putting out less than 20 horsepower. Ted walked around the airplane, inspecting it carefully. Other than that cast iron hunk of dead weight hanging off the front firewall, it was a beautifully done piece of equipment, and he told them so. Then, perhaps foolishly, he told them he'd fly it for them. Or maybe not so foolishly, because here's the thing, Model T motors were everywhere. They were probably the cheapest and easiest to find kind of power you could find in the 1930s. If the Stevens brothers had really done what they'd set out to do, created a new airplane design that could actually be powered in flight by a Model T engine, it could actually make them some money. Nobody had been able to do that before, and what Ted was looking at now seems to have convinced him that maybe, just maybe, they had. Ted climbed in and started the motor up. The familiar putt-putt of a Model T greeted his ears. He taxied to the edge of the field and paused, letting the motor warm up. Then he opened the throttle wide and the little home built started gathering speed down the field. About halfway down, Ted pulled back on the stick. The little plane lifted off, hung a second, and dropped back onto the field. He tried again. Same result. The engine was literally about 2 horsepower short of what it would take to power the plane at that altitude. But Ted liked what he had seen of the plane's handling. He taxied back over to where the Stevens boys were waiting, looking crestfallen beside the field. "Let's wait until we get a little wind, boys," he said. "We'll give her a try again." Several days later, with a gentle, steady breeze blowing along the airfield, the three of them returned to Knott's Field for a second run. This time it worked. Ted pulled back on the stick and the little flathead four motor roared valiantly and the tiny plane climbed off and went into a very, very slow climb as it neared the end of the field. The Stevens boys cheered as they watched it rise to about 300 feet and then they stopped cheering as it leveled off and started slowly sinking. Meanwhile, in the cockpit, Ted was nervously scanning the ground in front of him. The Model T engine was making just barely enough power to keep the plane in the air at full throttle. He hoped it wouldn't quit from the strain. He didn't have enough power to try any turns. He'd have to go straight ahead and hope for the best. Scanning his memory of the local geography, he remembered that there was a field a couple miles ahead, but it was strewn with lava rocks. He'd for sure hit one and break the plane. But 5 miles beyond that was a big open field. Could he make it? He glanced back over his shoulder to see how much ground he'd covered since leaving the airfield, and that's when he really got nervous. Because hanging in the air behind the little airplane was a great billowy contrail of steam. He was 2 miles into a 7-mile flight, and the engine was already overheating. Would it make it? Would he make it if it didn't? Ted focused on the task. The little airplane droned on, its engine getting hotter and hotter. Sooner or later, it would seize up. Then the field was in front of him, and he was touching down and bouncing to a stop. The steam poured out and surrounded him like a fog bank as he climbed gratefully down from the plane. He probably felt like kissing the ground. As a side note, it's interesting to speculate on what the Stevens plane could have done on an airfield in the Willamette Valley. It's pretty likely that if he'd been taking off from, say, the Eugene Airport, elevation 374 feet, more than 3,000 feet lower than Bend, he would have been able to do a little more with that little plane. With another home built that Ted was supposed to try out, he was saved from having to risk his neck by the home builder's impatience. Eddie Campbell of Prineville had, in 1930, got hold of the plans for a home-built design called the Storm's Flying Flivver, a tiny, high-wing monoplane powered by a Ford Model A engine. The Model A engine was roughly the same size and weight as the Model T, but made twice as much power. And Eddie worked at a Ford dealership's repair facility, so he had access to the equipment necessary to soup it up a bit. Ted was out of town for a week when Eddie finished his project and was not expected back for another 4 days. Eddie, already a fairly experienced glider pilot, grew impatient. Plus, it was his plane. He wanted to be the first to fly it. So he pulled it out and fired it up and pointed it down the field. It would not take off. He tried it several times. At the proper speed, it simply wouldn't leave the ground. Eddie looked it over, scratched his head, and decided the problem was that it was nose heavy. Getting his tools out, he took the wing loose and moved it forward a little bit. And then he climbed back in to try again. This time the plane came off the ground all right. It went straight into a steep climb, completely ignoring Eddie's attempts to control it. Stood on its tail, trying to hang from the prop about 100 feet in the air, and then stalled and pitched forward and slammed down into the ground nose first in a tangled heap. Eddie's friends gaped at the wreckage. Nothing moved in it. "Eddie's killed!" they shouted in horror and raced to the scene. They found Eddie slumped motionless amid the wreckage. Fearful of a fire breaking out, they each seized one of his shoulders and started trying to drag him out. "Hey, you guys," Eddie suddenly called out. "Take it easy, will you? My feet are stuck right through the firewall. You've got to get a saw and cut me out." They did so, and then hustled him to the doctor to get checked out. His skull was cracked, and he later learned that one of his leg bones had also been cracked, but overall he came out of the experience not much worse for wear. The same could not be said of the Storm's Flying Flivver, though. Key sources in this story have included works by Ted Barber, Jim Anderson, and Jeff Hill. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. One other thing, I've got a new audiobook out in the market this week, in case you're following that sort of thing, and unfortunately, no, it's not the first Orphaned Oregon history book. That'll be coming out probably in a couple of weeks. But this one is actually the first Lord Peter Wimsey book, Whose Body? By Dorothy L. Sayers. I recorded it as an experiment after noticing that the fake British accents that most people use to narrate these British mystery authors' books is kind of cloying after a little while. It occurred to me that maybe some people would like to hear it in a general American accent, so I recorded one, and the market seems to be responding to it fairly well so far. If you're interested in that sort of thing, check it out. I recorded it under a pseudonym, Justin Longbourn, because I figured that probably people who like Golden Age British detective mysteries might be put off by my backlist of H.P. Lovecraft stuff. Revenons à nos moutons. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Check out our hub page at offbeatoregon.com to explore other things we do and to find full citations and visuals that go with today's show. This podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. For details of that, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Offbeat Oregon History episodes are uploaded every weekday morning at around 6 a.m., so it'll be a few days before you get your next fix, but I don't have to tell you, Monday morning is going to be here in the blink of an eye. Well, that's the latest news from Offbeat Oregon History's Sulphur Springs studios, tucked away in the foothills of the Coast Range northwest of Corvallis, and so now it's time for you and me both to go out there and fill up the rest of the weekend, the 3-day weekend if you happen to have Monday off, with good stuff. Bye now.